My name's Professor Margaret Abernethy, and I'm Dean of the faculty, and it's my pleasure tonight to welcome you all to the Downing Lecture. I'd like to welcome my colleagues from the faculty, from outside the university, the students that we have tonight, and of course, the friends of the university who come to our public lectures. Before I actually introduce Stephen Jenkins, I'd like to just tell you a little bit about the person for whom this lecture is named. Richard Downing was the Ritchie Professor of Research in Economics at the University of Melbourne from 1954 until 1975. I've been doing a little bit of history of the faculty and the various appointments that have been made. The Ritchie Professor was one of the very first professors of research in the university, and the chair was created in 1927. Richard Downing made a significant contribution to economic research, but he also did much to guide and foster and mentor the research interests of other staff and his students. For 20 years, he edited the Economic Record and played a prominent part in the founding of the Institute of Applied Economic and Social Research. His contributions to the academic life of the university were not restricted to the faculty. He also served as Assistant Vice Chancellor and as Chairman of Ormond College Council. Outside the university, he was also on a number of bodies concerned with the arts, and from July 73, he was Chairman of the ABC. Over the years, the faculty has developed a fine tradition of attracting world-renowned economists and finance experts to deliver the Downing Lecture. And tonight, this tradition continues. It's a great privilege to have with us tonight Professor Stephen Jenkins and his wife, who I'd like to welcome, Dr. Lucinda Plant, his partner, Dr. Lucinda Plant. Stephen Jenkins is a professor of economics in the Institute for Social and Economic Research at the University of Essex in the UK, and he's just completed a term of office as the ISER director. He has wide-ranging, substantive research interests in income distribution and labor market topics and methodological research interests in microeconomic methods for longitudinal data. He is a member of the UK National Equality Panel. He was president of the European Society for Population Economics in 1998 and chair of the Council of the International Association for Research on Income and Wealth between 2006 and 2008. So you can see he is very well qualified to deliver the Downing Lecture. It's also a pleasure, Stephen, to have you in the faculty and the fact that you're going to spend some time with us in the Institute for the next couple of months. So tonight, I am delighted to welcome to the podium Professor Stephen Jenkins to provide the Downing Lecture. Stephen will take about 45 minutes, and then we'll have time for questions.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Maggie, for your introduction. And it's clearly an honor and a privilege for me to deliver the 2009 Downing Lecture. And from what I've read about Dick Downing, both the man and his work, we're following very large footsteps. He is clearly a giant of his generation, not just in Australian economics, but he's clearly been involved with so many other different things, both elsewhere in the university, as Maggie said, and outside academe. I mean, reading his biography, I've no idea how he managed to fit everything in. And I'm pretty sure that Downing would be pretty pleased that Melbourne is still continuing to develop an excellent tradition of social and applied economics, both in the economics department and in the Melbourne Institute, which he did so much to set up. I mean, Heinz Arndt described Downing's approach early in his career as quote, solid, sustained work to collect and improve statistics to analyse current problems, unquote. And this approach, which was Downing's, is continuing here, I think, ranging from the work on things like tax micro-simulation models, applied macroeconomics, through to the Hilda survey and research based on it. And it's wonderful stuff, and it's precisely this combination of stuff that it attracted me to visit Melbourne for 3 months. So say in advance, thank very much for your hospitality and for those who've organised this specific event. I'd like to think, too, that the topic of this talk would have been of interest to Downing, because it's related to several of the sorts of things that he worked on, though not quite in the same way. Whatever the case, I'm rather tickled to find that there is actually an Essex connection with him. His biographer, Brown, reports of Downing, who went to the UK for a sabbatical in 1967, that he had quite a lot of correspondence with Peter Townsend, who was then at Essex, and engaged in pioneering work on poverty measurement at the university there. So maybe this is continuing the loop. Anyway, so I hope that's the case. Anyway, on to my talk, and the first slide. The first slide gives me an opportunity for you to read my title. You've probably done that already, which you'll hear more about spaghetti. It gives me an opportunity to thank my funders of my research at Essex over the last decade and a half, not only the university itself, but also the Economic and Social Research Council. Like the Melbourne Institute, ISA is a soft money institute. We raise all our own funds, so I acknowledge our funders. The slide also gives me the opportunity to put up some pictures of the two institutes, and also to show you that Essex has sky that is at least as blue as in Melbourne. Long may it continue. Now, one of the problems, of course, of thinking about how to deliver a public lecture is how to deliver it and what sort of things to talk about. So what did the man himself say? Well, when he was talking to a branch of the Economic Society once, there was this following exchange, as reported by Heinz Arndt again. Arndt reports that the job of explaining the trade cycle theory to a lay audience gave Downing a lot of trouble. As Downing said, there's such a maze of stuff to cope with. Well, I'll give you a maze of stuff. And at one point, Downing thought a nice theme for a public address would be, well, I'm not going to read it out, but you can see the equations. Well, it was a joke, of course, Downing making a joke against himself, because he described himself as, quote, a poetic economist, and therefore a little better than the literary variety. Well, I'm not going to give you any equations, but I can't promise you any poetry, I'm afraid. So what am I going to do? Thinking about how to pitch a public lecture. One exhortation from a very eminent econometrician, Arnold Zellner, is get the facts. Sounds simple. Get the facts. And if you read his presidential address, he repeats that exhortation several times in his address. Problem, however, here are the facts, as I'm going to show you. And the rest of the lecture is about that. Basically, unravelling spaghetti is going from the left-hand side to the right-hand side and back again. Well, that's the idea. So how do I do it? What I'm going to do is use a statistical model to put order on all those messy wiggles on the left-hand side. So this is basically what applied econometricians these days do, try and put order in first structure on what is observed using statistical models. I won't use any equations. It's more pictures. And I'm going to try and follow Zellner again. Zellner goes on in his lecture about the KISS principle, which he's borrowed from somebody else, which is, as he says, keep it sophisticatedly simple, not keep it simple stupid, as it originally was, because, as he said, some models are stupid. And I hope you won't think my models are stupid by the end. You might agree instead with George Box, who says that all models are wrong, but some are useful. I'll try and argue that, by example, that my models are useful. So just to backtrack again, what I'm going to talk about tonight is the overall topic is how income varies with age, and I want to tease that out step by step. First of all, briefly discuss why the question matters. Secondly, talk a bit about what we mean by income. I assume you all know what we mean by age. Then we'll talk about data sources. Where do we get the data about income and age from, and other characteristics? Then, first look at spaghetti, the trajectory spaghetti. Then a brief talk about modelling approaches, then a bit about mine, then estimates, answering that question at the top, and then finishing off with some conclusions, challenges, and so on. So first of all, why is it that we want to learn about income age trajectories, profile of earnings, income, and so on over the life cycle? Two main reasons, I would argue. First of all, it's very important information for assessing contemporary social structure and social differences. Everybody from the ABS to academics at Melbourne and elsewhere produce estimates of the degree of inequality in society of income. Typically, however, it's from cross-sectional data. So how do we assess that inequality in incomes at a point in time? The problem is, of course, that in a cross-section at a point in time contains people of lots of different ages. But can you compare medical students with manual labourers? Medical students with a low income now and a high income later, typically. Manual labourers with a pretty flat profile over the life cycle and typically relatively low. So if, when we take our survey, we find all the medical students are all at the bottom, how do we assess that, taking into account the fact that they're going to have their expected earnings are higher later on? So we need information over the life about life cycle earnings to be able to put that in perspective and move from barroom discussion to more respectable research about how earnings differences actually do differ over the life cycle. Similarly, once we've generated those life cycle income profiles, we get information about lifetime income itself, the aggregate, and that is important information for assessing the extent to which the socioeconomic mobility across generations. In fact, a lot of the new research on intergenerational mobility has had to try and work out how to assess the degree of intergenerational mobility when you only have one or two observations on income in the parental generation and the children's generation. And one of the answers to solving some of those problems is to get more information. It's get more information about life cycle profiles. So if you think of that as possibly normative reasons for getting information, there are also positive reasons in the sense of thinking about redistribution across the life cycle. Transferring income, that is, over time to match people's spending needs. As I'm going to show you, income varies over the life cycle. But also there are important events that take place at different times during the life cycle. Things like education and training, children, retirement, they all cost money. And there are also important lifetime risks, of which I've given a couple of examples there, unemployment, sickness, and incapacity, and so on. And of course, these are clearly related to interesting policy issues about the nature of the resources that you require for savings now for later, and insurance against risky events. There are many ways of doing it, both private and collective, and I've given a list of some of the examples there, ranging through from families through to firms, workplace organisations, industry-level organisations, and things at the whole level of the economy, accompanied by government action, which may, of course, may be provision or simply setting the scene and constraints, regulation in other words. Related to this, in many countries, is explicit schemes of social insurance, which perhaps reaches its apogee in Western Europe, for example, the so-called Bismarckian welfare states like Germany, France, and so on. Less so in Australia, social insurance. Examples of these sort of things, so Australia does have examples of these, higher education loan schemes, but not unemployment insurance in a social insurance meaning, sickness insurance, and of course occupation and national retirement pension schemes. That's not to say these things don't exist or are talked about a lot, and Downing himself, of course, wrote a lot about these things, both the 57 pamphlet and more extended discussion later on, which led and has extended contributions to later national discussions about these various issues. I suspect from reading his biography that he wouldn't like to think of these things as just life cycle redistribution devices either. I think he's very clearly a person who saw the tax system as very much a vehicle for potential redistribution from rich to poor, full stop. Anyway, maybe we can come back and talk about that at the end. My point here is not so much to go into the policy aspects of it, to point out that, again, if you want to design these things efficiently, you need information about how people's income actually does vary over time, over the life cycle. Not only on average, it's all very well talking about an average person, but nobody really is the average person, and you'll see that that's one of the themes of my lectures. The diversity, fluctuations and so on of trajectories from the average are particularly important. We need to get some idea of what they are. So I've been using the term income rather loosely so far, but clearly it's going to matter for what we're going to talk about. I'm going to use three specific definitions. I'm not saying these are the best or indeed the only definitions, but they run from a series of extremes and therefore useful to illustrate my various arguments. So, three income concepts, and as we'll see, correspondingly, three sets of income recipients. Start, first of all, with an hourly wage. Clearly, the only people who have hourly wages are people who are in work, and if we focus in particular on those in employment, only for employees. You can think of this as relatively narrowly as the price of labour. Secondly, you might go to a rather broader measure, which is to take all adults and consider the income that each of them receives. And of course, people receive not just labour market income, whether from employment or self-employment, but they may receive cash benefits from the state or elsewhere, transfers from others, income from savings, investments, so on. So that's it. That's what I mean by individual income at the adult level. And then you can go relatively broader even still and think about some measure of needs-adjusted household income. And you can derive this for all individuals, adults and children. This is the definition that's used all around the world in most definitions of official income distribution statistics, not just in the UK, but also the US and also Australia. It's typical in virtually all academic work on the income distribution, so to speak, as well. So what you do is add up all those individual incomes in the household, all for everybody, including all the adults, children if they have the money, add it all up, and then you scale it to take account of the fact that $2,000 a month goes a lot further for a single person than it does for a family of four. So you divide it by a so-called equivalent scale factor that does this adjustment. If you're not familiar with these things, think about the idea that we're working with income per capita rather than income itself, because that takes account of the number of people within the household, except it's not income per capita. Basically, big heads count more than little heads. You have a bigger equivalent scale factor for adults than you do for children, and then you add them all up. Okay, and as I say, this is a measure of economic well-being that's most widely used around the world. So if we go back to think about those issues, about why we're motivated to think about life cycle distribution, we probably could think of reasons why we might want to employ all of those three measures for various different angles on the topics. I suspect, however, the more you want to talk about social welfare, in the general normative sense rather than the applied state distribution sense, that the broader concept is probably more relative and relevant. And we should come back, I think, later to think about this, because there is also the problem that even if the broader concept is more relevant, if you go narrow, in fact, if you go right down to hourly wages, it's much easier to model than a broader definition. Clearly, the reason is that there's much less going on. You're only dealing with one person, one income source, compared to the other ones. We shall return to that idea. Meanwhile, where do you get data from about income age trajectories? And here I want to make a contrast between cross-sectional data and longitudinal data. Cross-sectional data at a point in time, the ones I was referring to before, a standard survey of the very income and expenditure survey that's carried out all around the world is of this kind. They have take a survey of a large number of households and the individuals with them at a point of time, and clearly it will contain individuals of a range of ages, from newborn babies through to relatively old people. But if you want to look at how income varies with age from this sort of data set, then the problem is that this information is potentially misleading. If you ask yourself, for example, are the incomes of today's 40-year-olds a reliable guide to the incomes of today's 30-year-olds in 10 years' time? Well, maybe, but probably not. And They'll only be a good guy basically if the world doesn't change. And as we know, the world changes a lot. The economies go through different cycles of boom and bust. And more generally, even when it's in booming and bust, the cycles have different amplitudes. Put another way, there is growth, differing growth rates. So people can experience different income trajectories related to those sorts of things. So basically, just using a cross-section of the point in time can be misleading. And I'm going to give you an example of that later from British data. So what I'm going to favour, by contrast, is longitudinal data. I'm not saying they're perfect, but they've got intrinsic advantages. If you want to follow individuals over time, longitudinal data are them. So basically, instead of the scenario I was talking about before, what we do here is actually follow 30-year-olds over 10 years until they're 40, either looking back or prospectively using a panel survey. Biggest contrast I'd like to make is between, on the one hand, administrative data, which are typically derived as a sort of byproduct of the administration of benefit systems all around the world, and best example of where these work best, I guess, is in the Nordic countries. These administrative data offer very large sample sizes. Good thing. Typically less measurement error, because the very process of checking people's incomes as a process part of the system reduces measurement error. But on the other hand, as I said, they've developed for the process of administering benefit systems. So they don't care about a lot of the things that researchers care about. They don't collect a very wide range of income definitions. They've got what I've called possible truncations. That is, they don't collect information about the people at the very bottom or at the very top. For example, in Britain, if you're below the so-called lower earnings limit for national insurance contributions, you don't appear in some of these sorts of records. And similarly, if you have got an income above the upper earnings limit, they don't bother to collect any more information other than that you're at that limit. So there is top and bottom coding in this data, which can be a serious issue in these things. And they, of course, only collect the information that is required for the administration of benefits, which is relatively limited. You may want more. On the other hand, they may follow people over the whole of their working lives, a very long time, and that's the sort of thing that we want. But if we can get these data, can we get these data? Typically not, for a whole range of reasons, ranging from just bloody-mindedness in a country in which I was born, through to other issues about, more genuine issues about confidentiality, privacy, and so on. Contrast administrative data with panel surveys, examples like the British Social Panel Survey or Melbourne's own HILDA. Problem with panel surveys is they've got smaller sample sizes relative to these administrative data surveys. Potentially larger measurement error, and you may come back to ask questions about this later. But on the other hand, you've got much more flexibility, because basically we make the survey. You've got possibility of constructing many more income definitions. In fact, the range that I was telling you about before, the less truncations, many more variables. You may be constrained, however, by the number of years that people have followed. It depends on the survey. HILDA's relatively short. VHPS has been going longer, and others even longer. But we'll see to the extent to which that limits things. And, of course, these things are now easily available to bona fide researchers. There are possibilities of combining these sources. We'll return to that at the end. Before going to some numbers and models, let me tell you a bit about an example of the longitudinal data that I'm using in this study. If you know anything about HILDA, this is the British version. It just started a bit earlier. And we, of course, were following in the footsteps of other people as well, but in particular the German panel, the socioeconomic panel in Germany, and the panel study of income dynamics in the US, which is the granddaddy of them all and started in 1968. All these other panels, the VHPS starts with a nationally representative sample of the private household population at the beginning. In our case, it was autumn 1991. It's a large sample. It's more than 10,000 adults in some 5,000 individuals. 10,000 adults in some 5,000 households, and it covers at that time over 13,000 individuals, so around 3,000 kids. And these people have been followed up ever since, annually. So we've now done 18 waves of VHPS. And the surveys maintain their representativeness of the original sample population by following them over time, regardless of whether or not the family splits up, you know, for example, through divorce and so on. Both wings are followed of the various families. Children of panel members become members in their own right at the age of 16. So basically the survey reproduces itself in the same way as the population does. So using these data, you can follow people over time. You can build up trajectories. But as we shall see, we only have 17 waves data, and 17 waves is not yet a whole working life. On the other hand, we can construct the three income variables that I was telling you about before. And we can choose our sample. Basically, I'm going to focus on people over the age of 25 to get rid of some of the complications at the beginning. So let's now look at some of the trajectory spaghetti. I'm going to argue that things look like that. Okay, so here's our first look at what I'm going to call trajectory spaghetti. And I've drawn these two pictures, men on the left, women on the right. I've focused on a relatively tightly defined group. Two reasons for tightly defining group. One, so I can fit everybody on the picture. A bit more importantly also, it's because I want to basically show you that even if you control relatively tightly for important characteristics, like when people were born, their birth year, and their educational qualifications, A-levels, by the way, are essentially the examination that's done at the end of secondary school, and if you get good A-levels, it qualifies you for university entrance. So these are well-qualified people, born in 1966, and these graphs follow over time, so up basically age, which is on the horizontal axis in both cases, age across there from 25, and this is hourly earnings on the vertical axis. A mess, I think, not quite like the trajectory, the spaghetti, but you get the idea. Note that these lines are only a maximum of 17 years long, because the panel has only followed them for 17 years, so we're only able to collect that amount of information. If I were to draw pictures for other people, but in different birth years, we would be able to draw pictures covering the rest of the axis. What inferences can we draw about income age trajectories from these pictures? Not a huge amount. It's a bit difficult. We might say that, well, the picture for men looks, broadly speaking, a bit above that for women, at least on average, but it's a mess. Perhaps it looks like men's trajectories are rising on average, and women's are flatter, maybe. A lot of jumping around, isn't there? Well, one thing we could do is take logs. I mean, look at things on a log scale, because economists like doing that. But it might help compress things. The higher incomes bring them in a bit. So if you think about this picture here, as we go from 10 to 20, as we go move vertically, a gap of the same distance corresponds to the same absolute difference in earnings. What we could do if we move now to put it on a log scale, you can now see that an absolute, the same vertical distance here now transforms into earnings ratios, proportionate differences, if you will. And if you look at things like this, I think, having stared at these quite a lot, I think logs work better in terms of those sorts of patterns that I was talking about before, but it only takes you a limited way ahead. We, you know, in terms of those generally limited conclusions about what that you want to draw. So we still want to go further in terms of the model. What about those other income definitions? I'll just rush through. For exactly the same group, just think about it. If we move to individual income, we're now going to be adding in additional income sources, and also, of course, going to be changing the scale. But I'm now going to move from pounds per hour to pounds per month, so you've got to multiply it up by a factor of around 150, that is, say, 40-hour week times four weeks per month. And so the scale has changed, but not only that, you move to this other greater spaghettiness because there are these other income sources there. That's a mess. Even if you take logs, still a bit of a mess. Now, what if you then go to equalised family income? So we're now pooling income within families. So there's equal sharing within families by assumption. So it's going to bring things in a bit, this spaghetti, at least in terms of the vertical, you know, fluctuations, you would think. But boy, I would say that it's still a mess. And even taking logs, still a bit of a mess. So what do we do? How do we think about it? What's driving this sort of mess? So how do we think about income and age trajectories? Well, we could go back in time again, beyond Downing. Go back to a famous example of Seebohm Rowntree, who did research in the town of York in 1901. I partly use this also because I did my doctorate in the same city 80 years later. After the publication of this. So Rowntree is very famous for this particular diagram and for this quotation, which many others have used, of arguing that the life of a labourer is characterised by five alternating periods of want and comparative plenty. So he's got an emphasis on life course events. Okay, so these are the things at the top. I mean, basically, what he hasn't put also is when this labourer was a kid themselves. And as these things happen, as the person grows up, gets earnings themselves and leaves home, their income goes up, and there's possibly two incomes coming in, they start to have kids, it goes down again, kids leave home, remember they'd be leaving home probably around 12, 13, if not earlier, and beginning to earn, and then leaving home later, so there are fewer people at home, and this is the sort of height of earnings, and then you know, work finishes, they're left on their own, poverty in retirement. So there are these fluctuations over time. Very important, very influential stuff, and it influenced a lot of people thereafter, including policymakers in Britain. My point for now is not to damn Rowntree. I think, in fact, no, we should praise him, but just to point out, for my purposes, that a lot of this is about averages, okay? York, in case you don't know, it always used to be christened as a town of chocolate and railways. York is not just Rowntree's. There are a couple of other important chocolate factories as well, though Rowntree's was the largest. But the other large employer in York, for example, was the London and North East Railway. And, you know, this is probably not what was happening to the LNER manager. And, of course, Rowntree did later surveys of poverty in York, and it's not clear whether or not these exactly the same things picture would apply. And after all, one of the points of his later surveys was to point out that the causes of poverty had in fact changed over time. And moreover, the nature of the family life cycle or demographic events through the life cycle that he talked about there is rather an old one and has to be updated. Women don't really appear in this one very much at all. There are new risks too, of course, things like divorce, lone parent families, and so on. Anyway, take away the important thing about life course events lack of divergences from the average. What do modern day economists say about this? And here I'll probably get damned from the audience because I'm going to be really crude and absolutely no subtleties, and I'm just going to summarise it in terms of a couple of stories. I think if what you would take away, at least from Economics 1 through Economics 3, is about what economists think about how earnings, and I emphasise earnings or wages, how they go over the working life, is that they rise over time, but at a decreasing rate. Right back from Mintz's and Becker's influential work. So they have a concave trajectory, if you will. And the reason for that, the explanations for this is the original Mincerian and Becker one, which is in terms of so-called human capital. That is, early on in their lives, people are making investments in education and training, which is financed by foregone lower earnings. So that's the beginning of their life. And then they get their awards later in life. So low at the beginning, high later on. You get this concave trajectory. Or half generation later, there is also coming from the Chicago area, an influential personnel economic story, which has got nothing to do with investment and training. It's all to do with the nature of employment contracts and incentives. And one version of the story says something like that employment contracts, which combine low pay early on with high pay later, and that high pay might be deferred pay like a pension, is important, that structure, the sort of early versus later structure, because that provides incentives to employees not to shirk while they're working. Because if they shirk, they risk dismissal. If they get dismissed, they miss out on the loot at the end. That's the idea. So for mere incentive reasons, you might have these concave profiles. Now, there's not much in those stories about variations from the average, and I think it's true to say that heterogeneity doesn't enter in these economist stories a lot. There is variation in initial earnings, and to be fair to Becker, for example, there's a lot about so-called differences in ability. What ability is not actually defined in gory detail, but so hence I put quotation marks around it. But there are some variations in there, but the general human capital and personal economic stories is about averages. Trajectory crossings comes about through, for example, things like employers may take people on. They don't know that what that ability in quotation marks is, but they learn over time and then adjust people's earnings over time to take into account both these the revelation of both unobserved heterogeneity as well as the observed heterogeneity. So those are the sorts of stories that lie behind these things, and which would lead us to expect, at least from the economist story and from the earnings side, concave trajectories. So how should we think about it if we want to model it in a statistical or econometric sense? What I'm going to do is now set out a rough idea of a model, and I'm only going to sketch it, because as I said, no equations. I'm going to be borrowing heavily on a literature, so-called variance components literature, and in fact a sort of bastardized version of it, but to go back to George Box, my model is definitely wrong, but I hope it's useful. And the advantage of this model, I argue in the accompanying paper, is that you can apply it to these three income definitions and get quite a long way that many more sophisticated models can also do so. So how can we think about it? Start with two individuals. Think about two men born in the same year, and they both left school at age 16 with GCSE. So that's the exam taken around just in the year before people can leave at the minimum school leaving age. It's the main exam prior to the A-levels that I referred to before. I'm referring to them as John the plumber and Mike the motor mechanic. And for both of them, earnings are relatively low and rise over time. The way I've drawn the pictures, you can't really see the concavity, but there is some concavity in there to respect those stories that I was telling you about before. So building in some barroom conceptions about relative earnings trajectories of plumbers and motor mechanics. I've got John, he does his apprenticeship. He starts with relatively, compared to Mike, he starts with relatively low initial earnings, but his earnings rise more steeply thereafter compared to this guy, Mike, who's a motor mechanic, who starts with higher initial earnings, lower growth rates thereafter. And of course, if we have these sort of trajectories, then these trajectories will eventually cross. So we're getting towards some of the things that we were talking about before. Differences in initial earnings and differences in the slope of these things, leading to some of the things we're talking about. So one way of then thinking about it in a model-based sense is to, well, if we just have these two guys, we could think of an average income age trajectory. And I put average in quotation marks because nobody need be at the average, but it's summarising the group average trajectory, if you will. I'm just banging the line through that. That's heavy line there. And of course, these are John's and Mike's trajectories that we had before. And then we can, when we start thinking about it in terms of modelling these things, there are the differences in starting points, there are differences in slopes, and there's some other stuff that gives wiggles. So I tried to draw here a normal distribution because it goes into the statistical model. Basically, around the average, this is supposed to give an idea to you that there is a whole distribution of starting points, of which just John and Mike's values are draws from that distribution. So a whole distribution. The average, round about the average, is where the concentration is greatest. Down at the tails, is the chances that are much, much lower. So that's the idea there. And there's also differences in slopes. I'm afraid my drawing was not so good here. Excuse the wiggles, they're not supposed to be there. But the idea here was just to draw out for any given starting point, you may have a distribution in slopes as well. So we can characterize people in terms of differences in starting at the beginning of, earnings at the beginning of their working lives. And even for among those with the same starting point, there may differences in slope. Now, of course, in terms of the trajectory spaghetti that we saw earlier on, there are no wiggles. So basically we mop things up with basically an error term at the end, stochastic, idiosyncratic error at the end. And we'll talk about the role that plays shortly. Okay, so the model elements are just as I've described. And going back to, this is in a sense more economist, in the sense it's built on that concave earnings trajectory idea, than it's Roundtree. Basically, all those important things that Roundtree was talking about, those important life course events, are stuffed into the error. Must be, because those trajectories that I was showing you were smooth. Moreover, in there also goes genuine transitory variation. You might do a bit more overtime this year, a bit less next year, and so on. Basically a stochastic variable, or there may be a measurement error. So basically there's a lot of sins being kept under that transitory variation heading. But essentially those are the key aspects of the model. It's starting points, slopes, error, as well as that, how you characterize that average trajectory. So what does the model say about how things are, at least in Britain today? And I should have said earlier, you know, this is all about Britain, I'm afraid. Leave the stuff for the Pilger people to do Australia. So let's think about some of the trajectories here. I'm going to be showing you pairs of pictures. Men and women are so different in terms of their income trajectories that we have to draw them separately, always. In fact, I go further. I'm going to be giving you pictures for 12 groups. So breakdowns by the two sexes, two birth cohorts, basically before 55 and after 55. And three levels of educational qualification, basically no qualifications, some qualifications, and whether or not somebody has got A levels or above. Very crude, but as I said, this is trying to tease out key elements of structure. And of course, we're also pushing against the limits of the survey data about cell sizes. But I think in terms of even characterizing people in terms of those, we're going quite a long way. The other thing I have to say is that when we want to characterize people's trajectories in the way that I'm doing, what we want to do is focus on things that are fixed or given throughout their working lives, at least in terms of the exercise that I'm engaged in. What we don't want to do is classify people in terms of things that might change over time, family type, occupation, so on. We've got to be rather careful about how we handle those things. So just to be very clear, I'm working basically within and between groups, so comparing where the 12 groups are defined in terms of those categories. So, in terms of, here are the pictures that we get, and here is the legends down here. The dark lines in all these pictures are going to refer to the younger cohort, the ones who were born later, the one 55 or afterwards. Distinctions between the dotting or solid line according to their qualifications, left and right, for men and women. And now we're beginning to get something about out of these average trajectories. If we focus on men for just a second, that you can see, for example, that the later born cohorts definitely doing better than the earlier born cohorts. Those three ones up here are higher than these ones. And note we also come back to this point before about the coverage of the life cycle with the 17 years, about how much we can cover with these different groups. Moreover, you can see that educational qualifications are good for you. It's probably a good environment in which to say that. It does pay off. You can see, for example, that that it can make a difference between of at least £4 an hour. I should have said these are hourly wages on a log scale. A difference of around £4 an hour down here between this group, which is quite a lot, particularly when it builds up over time. If you compare left-hand side and the right-hand side, then there are big differences between men and women. In fact, huge differences between men and women, even if, you know, controlling for cohort and controlling for education. So even in the highest qualified group, you've got a difference, say, at age 40 of a wage per hour around 12 compared to about 9.5 for women. These are big differences. Now, one of the things you might wonder about these pictures are some of the wiggles that are going on at the various ends, and you ask yourself, how the heck can those sort of things go on? People's things jump up at the very end. And what's going on here is essentially, my explanation is in terms of there are people dropping out of the labour force, the people with the lowest wages. So what you're getting left with is the people, basically those who can earn a decent whack, stay in at the very end. The next point I want to make is to hark back to my point earlier, is that longitudinal picture differs from the cross-sectional one. Okay, cross-sectional is potentially misleading. So I've taken some data from our NEP forthcoming report, transformed it into a way so that we've got the same scale as we had in our previous picture on these things. I've got age groups along here, I'm afraid, because that's the way in which the data come, and we've got red and blue distinguishing men and women. But this is the cross-sectional picture derived from the labour force survey at a particular time. And what do you draw out from those pictures? That in terms of the heights of the pictures, they're broadly speaking correspond at, well, in some rasping. But the way in which they're tilted is totally different, I would argue. Okay, so in terms of much, we get more steepness going on in these pictures than we do in this. Of course, this is related to economy-wide, the secular growth that it's experienced at different times for different groups. It is not picked up by these things. It's sort of built in, I guess, somehow into these. But particularly if you look at the picture for women, very different, say, for these groups like here and the ones that you see here. So this is with earnings. And notice for women, this dip I didn't mention before is probably driven by things like the part-time wage penalty. And as most part-time earners in Britain are women, this is what's explaining this in there. Okay, so that's the first lesson, is beware the average. A second, just to hammer home that point, is to point out the degree of differences, how much there is distribution of income at any given age. So this picture is bringing this out. So we've got the logarithm of wages, along here, and at age 40 this is. So these blobs in the middle summarise where those points on those graphs that we had before. But these lines show you how wide the distribution is dispersed. It goes from this side anyway, the person at the 30th percentile through to the person at the 70th percentile. So covering 3/4 of the distribution, you can see there's a big spread. So even when you control tightly for earning, for characteristics, there is a big distribution within. And that spread is such that there is overlapping across these groups, and moreover, there's overlapping across the sexes. So even on average, though women are paid less than men, there's clearly some women who are paid at least as well as some men, though you can see from the pictures about that distribution controlling for age. The next picture just emphasises that point, but I won't talk about that one due to the way the time is going. But I just want to make the point about dispersion again. The way in which I made the point about dispersion just now was focusing on one particular age. And I said there was a lot of dispersion in earnings at any given age. Okay, well, you could have got that from a cross-section survey. What we really want to know about is dispersions in trajectories. And this picture tries to bring that out in one way. I'm going to show you another one in a second. And this is just showing you what the model predicts. So simulating from the model trajectories for 6 different people to show you for men and for women the sorts of trajectories that you can get out of these things, and you can see reflecting differences in starting point and differences in slope. Some very big differences between what's going on, and moreover the differences between what the model is projecting, these differences here, and the differences, the wiggles that are going on there. So we're actually, I would claim, getting closer to the spaghetti. So put it another way, I'm claiming that on the basis of this evidence in the next slide, that the crude sort of model that I'm using comes closest to putting structure on that spaghetti, and there we are, to run it home. So we have our spaghetti and so on. So the unravelling of the spaghetti that I was referring to in my title is really, in some ways, if you take it literally, going from this picture that I showed you at the beginning of earnings against age, in fact, log earnings against age. If we look at the fitted log earnings against age, using the characteristics observed and unobserved in the model to predict, you get the unravelled spaghetti, the uncooked spaghetti. Okay, so in a sense, that's going on. So that this is part of my claim about the models that you can do. Okay, as time is proceeding, I won't really show you the pictures for the other income definitions, individual income and so on, but I basically want to argue that there are going to be clear differences in average trajectories across those, and perhaps just quickly, if you eyeball these pictures, you can see that the pictures for these different groups, at least on average, are very different according to the different income definitions. In particular, once you move to equivalized household income, and you get much closer dips associated with having kids, part-time earnings, and so on, as you might expect. Okay, but this stuff is very different from what you get from the cross-sectional picture. Okay, and if you repeat the exercise in terms of dispersion, you get the sorts of things that I've been showing. So to conclude, the first thing I've been trying to tell you is that longitudinal data are essential for driving income age trajectories. They give you a different picture. But existing longitudinal survey sources are not perfect. They remain limited. So we need lots more money to make them even better. We've got to keep them going and so on. More seriously, I mean, we have to remember that the length of the observation period is important. So we're going to have to use some sort of model anyway to stretch things out to get beyond that. There are important issues about measurement error or about unravelling what I was calling that error turf, the sorts of things that are in there. And this raises questions about the potential for linked administrative and survey data. Try and get the best of both worlds. There are serious issues here. I mean, it has been shown that it can be done, for example, in the health and retirement study in the US and the English longitudinal study of ageing. It is possible to do this, but with more compliant respondents, so to speak, older groups, the population. There are also issues about having to get informed consent, consent rates, and so on. May not be 100%. In fact, they're typically 3/4 or less, and that raises a question about bias itself. But I think there's important potential to be explored. So, data are important. Secondly, once you've got the data, beware of the average. Okay? Even within tightly defined groups, there's substantial heterogeneity in individuals' trajectories. I motivated the talk in terms of why we might be interested in this stuff for various social welfare and life cycle redistribution issues, and that the idea that broader measures of income rather than an hourly wage might be important. But if you accept that argument, then I think you also have to accept that there are a lot of challenges for modelling, both the theorists among you and the empirical workers. As I've explained, if you use this wider definition of income, which is the one that's widely used in poverty statistics and other official statistics, income, as measured in this way, is affected by who you live with. And lots of different income sources, not just the labour market, okay, state benefits. Also, demographic events make a difference. They affect how many people are contributing to the family pot and how many that the family needs at any particular time, as was encapsulated within the equivalent scale, as I described it. Okay, so, and there's also the issues of labour force participation as well as pay. So there's lots and lots of things that are going on. So, of course, it makes it really, really interesting and really, really hard. So, but I think it's important. And I think economists have focused on men's pay. They've done a lot of good work there. But there's, lots more that could be done, in particular integrating the sort of Roundtree-ish things that I were talking about before. And just another thing I haven't mentioned is that the sorts of models I've been talking about before effectively characterise everybody, regardless of whether or not there's somebody right at the bottom doing a relatively menial wage job, or somebody sitting down in one of those glass towers on South Bank, with high, not entrepreneurial income, still even labour income, but it may be derived, you have to model it in rather a different way. The other sorts of conclusions I'd like to draw is that there are challenges for policy-related research that are associated with these deviations from the average. It raises questions about how much variability is actually predictable. I mean, there's a prior question of how much is real, of course. That's the measurement error issue. But that aside, this issue about predictability. I mean, predictability is important, obviously, for any risk-sharing institution, whether it be the family or other institutions, and so on. I mean, there's been some work done on this by Richard Blundell and others, Cunier and Heckman and others, but it's pretty complicated stuff. So there's important work beginning here. Another thing you might think about in terms of this is that translate variability into income risk. If you're thinking here, looking forward, and you've got this fluctuating profile ahead of you, that sounds like income risk. Well, there's been a lot of arguments, at least in the North America and the USA, that this income risk has been increasing over time. And if you want a good read on this, read Jacob Hacker's book called The Great Risk Shift, who talks about a big increase in income risk in the USA. It's all related to this sort of stuff, and it's stuff I think that needs to be examined. And finally, if we have all this stuff going on, does it have any implications for the institutions and their regulation? There's certainly changes been going on, at least in North America and certainly also in the UK. There's been a big shift away from social insurance principles. There's been a shift away from defined benefit pensions to defined contribution pensions and so on, fluctuations. So if you're combining that with an increase in income risk in a secular fashion, I think we have an issue about who should bear the responsibilities and who can bear the responsibilities for saving for old age and so on and so on. So that's all, folks. Thank you very much.